In his new book, The Working Poor, Invisible in America, David Shipler writes about the people he describes as living at the bottom of the working world, the people who serve you Big Macs, help you find merchandise in Walmart, harvest your food, clean your offices, and sew your clothes. Shipler reported for the New York Times from 1966 to 1988. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, Arab and Jew, Wounded Spirits in a Promised Land. He spent over 5 years researching his new book on the working poor. President Bush has proposed giving renewable visas to illegal immigrants. Would you explain his proposal?
Well, I think the details of his proposal have yet to be outlined sufficiently to know how helpful it will be. I think the idea is good in the sense that it seems to reconcile both the human interest and the American economic interest. I mean, I remember a few years ago, I was in Maine in the summer, and hearing two news reports on the radio back to back. The first extolled the wonders of the current blueberry crop. It's a big deal in Maine, and it was a great year for blueberries. The second reported on roadblocks that had been set up by the immigration officials and state police on the Maine Turnpike to intercept undocumented workers who were coming to pick the blueberry crop. It was a perfect example of the country working at cross purposes with itself. We need the labor, and yet we make life very difficult for people who try to fulfill those roles. So I think that the basic concept of legalizing immigrants who are here to work is a good one. The question is whether it can be done without making them beholden to certain employers, because that will create an exploitative relationship that exists already economically, but it will simply formalize it through government. I think also because, most immigrants who are here in an undocumented status move from job to job. I mean, they don't stay in one job very long. Many of the jobs are seasonal. Migrant workers especially, but even in Los Angeles, where I spent some time in the garment district, there are lots of fly-by-night sewing shops, often called sweatshops, where people are also paid on a piecework basis. And sometimes these companies will evaporate overnight or over the weekend, and the workers will come in Monday morning and find nobody there, and they are still owed a week's pay, and then the companies will reconstitute themselves, down the block under a different name and that sort of thing. So if this visa idea relies on some kind of permanent or long-term employer-employee relationship, it won't work, and people on both sides, that is, employers and employees, will simply evade it.
You visited the garment district in Los Angeles. What are some of the working conditions that you found there?
The working conditions in the garment district in Los Angeles vary from decent to outrageous. The decent places are, by and large, the designers who pay their people a bit better, who cut the pieces of the clothing, and then they send those pieces in stacks to the sewing contractors. And the sewing contractors also vary, but many of them are very, very poor places. There are these buildings, 10, 12-story buildings in L.A. Some of them are poorly ventilated. People are crowded together. They get paid very often on a piecework basis. This little amount per fly that they sew into a pair of trousers, and they have to sew X number in order to get the minimum wage, and the minimum wage is not always attainable at that rate. There are no benefits. They're paid only when they're at work. So if there isn't work by the company, they're simply told not to bother to come in, which means that they're not basically working a full day or a full week. So even if they make the minimum wage, it doesn't come out to a living wage for sure. Minimum wage wouldn't anyway, but it doesn't come out to anything close to what you would imagine was needed to support a family.
What populations were working in these factories?
In the factories in L.A., you saw a lot of Latinos and Asians primarily. People from Korea, Hong Kong, Mexico, Guatemala. There were also some European Americans, but not very many. Most of the people I saw who were workers were minorities, and mostly immigrants.
Would you guess that this represents any kind of change in American working conditions? Would you guess that there have always been sweatshops that garment workers have to work in, but the population of the people in those sweatshops have changed? Or do you think that the working conditions have gotten different?
I think there's always been one particular sector of the garment industry like this, but what's happened in the last 20 years is that so many of these sewing jobs have gone overseas that most of the clothing that we wear in the United States, my guess is, has been assembled abroad. The garment district in L.A. handles clothing that where designers don't want to wait the time it takes to send their design or even their material overseas and then have it shipped back. They're a little more sensitive to fads and fashions, and they need the clothing produced more quickly. So those are, I think, mainly the kind of garment factories that you find in L.A. I would add that the decline of unions in the United States has had an impact in the garment industry and other industries. There are garment workers, especially in New York, who are unionized. There are some in L.A. who are unionized in other parts of the country. But increasingly, there's been a development of these very small sewing factories, often run by immigrants themselves, that appear and then disappear after a few months. And the workers in those are not members of any labor union, so they don't get any kind of union wage or benefits.
Did you talk to any of the employers who own the sweatshops that you visited in Los Angeles?
I talked to, well, employers who own the sweatshops would not talk to me. But I did talk to a couple who own better places, and they who railed against the sweatshops, by the way, who didn't like the sweatshops because they undercut them in terms of cost. In other words, if you want to pay your workers decently, you're going to have to charge a bit more per item of clothing. And it's very hard to compete with the sweatshops that are exploiting workers just down the hall sometimes.
So they were in a bind, these employers were in a bind about whether to pay a better wage and maybe go out of business because they couldn't be competitive or stay competitive and feel that they're exploiting their workers.
They were in a bind in a way. One fellow struck me particularly. He was an immigrant from some 20, 30 years ago from Beirut, Lebanon, and he had a small sewing company that did very high-end evening gowns and so forth. And he had a pretty stable workforce, all women who were very good sewers, highly skilled, and he was paying them a little bit better. He was paying them, I think, $8 to $10 an hour. That's pretty high for garment workers. But as a result, labor was a huge percentage of his cost, and therefore he had to charge more to the designers who, you know, wanted him to put together their garments, and it was very hard to compete with the people down the hall. I mean, he told me he used to hire undocumented workers, and now he hires only documented workers, and he hates the competitors who hire undocumented workers because they pay less and they can undercut him. However, he has carved out a little bit of a niche for himself in that he does very elaborate and high-quality work, whereas some of the less expensive places throw things together pretty quickly.
My guest is David Shipler, author of The Working Poor, Invisible in America. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Shipler, and his new book is called The Working Poor, Invisible in America. One accusation against the immigrant workforce, particularly the undocumented workforce, is that some workers and I think some unions would say that it keeps wages down. What were your thoughts about that issue after having investigated so many facets of the working poor?
I'll tell you my thought about that. My thought is that wages are always going to be very low at a certain unskilled level of the economy. And the key issue here is to open pathways to advancement and improvement and education and training. There's no way that American workers can compete globally if they are doing very menial work, because you have to have a fairly high income in the United States to live decently, and you don't in Cambodia or Sri Lanka. And therefore, if the same jobs are being done here as in Cambodia, the American worker is always going to be at a disadvantage. So the answer is really not preventing jobs from going overseas, because, you know, jobs are like water, they flow to the cheapest level. The answer is to make sure that we have a workforce in this country that has opportunity and training so that people can advance. Our educational system really doesn't provide for that now. We've decimated our vocational school structure because we have this idea that everyone ought to go to college. Well, that sounds great, but if everyone goes to college, then A, we're not going to have anybody to do the menial jobs that also need to be done. But beyond that, not everybody does go to college. And if the high schools prepare people only for college and people then don't go, if they either graduate from high school and go into the job force, or if they drop out of high school, or even if they go to college for a year or two and drop out, which many do, you have a whole population of unskilled folks, basically, who really can't make their way in the workplace and have no educational structure to move back into and advance through, except some job training programs, which are good but need more federal funding.
We're in a presidential election year. You point out in your book that nobody needs the government more than the poor, yet no population is as underrepresented in the vote as the poor.
I think it's fair to say, I mean, you know, if all those under 10,000 a year, or say under 25,000, let's say, a year voted at the same rate as those who are wealthier, you'd have more than 6 million additional voters. If they voted according to their interests, political candidates would really have to take notice of this problem or this whole set of problems and address them, because they'd have to appeal to these folks, because they're the swing voters, in effect. They're the silent voters who could make or break a particular candidate. There's almost no state where a candidate for president wins with more than 5% of the vote. So these folks, if they voted in a block according to their own interests, would really make a difference. But why don't they vote? Well, I think there are lots of different reasons. I asked everybody. I just talked to a fellow in New Hampshire, Tom King, who I've followed for many, many years, his family, and he didn't vote in the New Hampshire primary. And I said, how come? He said, I was looking for a job. He got laid off 3 weeks ago from a boot factory, and he doesn't have any work. Now, I'm sure Tom could have found a half an hour to go to the polling place and vote during that day, but he's never felt that politics makes any difference to him. He can't make a connection between who gets elected and how his life is going to change. So, and I think that's pretty common for lots of people in this situation. They don't feel that their vote really is going to have an impact on the way they live.
David Shipler, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure to be with you, Terry.
David Shipler's new book is called The Working Poor, Invisible in America.